voice.
Israel's emergency services say at least 10 people have been killed and more than 100 injured in the latest wave of Iranian missile strikes across central and northern regions of the country. In response, the Israeli military has launched further attacks on Tehran, hitting an oil facility and sites reportedly connected to Iran's nuclear program. Sakir Starmer says the additional RAF jets being sent to the Middle East are a contingency support, and he appealed for calm on both sides. President Trump has warned Iran that any form of aggression towards the US will trigger a powerful military response. A meeting of the leaders of the world's richest countries will start in Canada later, as the annual G7 summit marks its 50th anniversary. Top of the agenda will be international conflicts, from the escalating situation in the Middle East to Russia's war in Ukraine. The Conservatives have continued their criticism of Sakir Starmer for what they call his delays in setting up a statutory review into the sexual exploitation of children by grooming gangs. Sakir announced the inquiry in England and Wales yesterday, despite previously dismissing calls for one. The Shadow Chancellor Mel Stride said the Prime Minister had been pressured into another U-turn. Funerals are expected to take place today for several victims of the plane crash in the Indian city of Ahmedabad. Authorities have so far returned 12 bodies to their families, with around 30 victims officially identified. The FBI is offering a $50,000 reward in the hunt for a gunman who killed a Democratic Party politician and her husband in the US state of Minnesota. Melissa and Mark Hortman were shot dead at their home yesterday. Another senior Democrat was wounded, along with his wife. Protests against tourism are due to be held in some of the most popular destinations in Spain, Portugal and Italy. These include Barcelona, Ibiza, Palma in Mallorca and Venice. The demonstrations have been organised by a coalition of campaign groups who argue over-tourism is having a negative social and environmental impact. Morrisons and Sainsbury's have been formally asked by the government to stop advertising tobacco products in their supermarkets. Ministers say ads for a device which heats tobacco rather than burning it break the rules. And the weather: variable cloud and sunny spells for most, some isolated showers this afternoon. BBC News, it's 2 minutes past 12. Now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The American singer-songwriter Suzanne Vega released her first studio album almost exactly 40 years ago, and it soon found an audience, and particularly here in the UK, where it sold more than 300,000 copies. Listeners responded to her understated acoustic sound and thoughtful lyrics in songs like Marlena on the Wall and Luca. Another of her songs, Tom's Diner, took on a life of its own. It's been sampled by dozens of artists, and one remix became a global hit. Suzanne recently released her 10th studio album, Flying with Angels, and will be embarking on a major tour with dates in England and Scotland later this year. You've brought a fascinating list of music, Suzanne Rachmaninoff, Philip Glass, and I'm delighted to say Bartok. But I think we're going to start and actually end with Debussy.
Yes, I'm really pleased to see that. It's a nice way to begin and end, I think.
Why do you love Debussy?
I love these two pieces because I connect them with my daughter. My daughter loves the piano. She'd been studying it since she was 7 years old. And Clair de Lune's a piece. Every time I hear it, I think of her at the piano, working diligently at it for an hour or so at a time.
Clair de Lune by Claude Debussy, performed by Alice Sarah Ott. Tell me a little bit, Suzanne Vega, about your childhood, because I think age 2.5 you moved to New York.
Yes, not on my own, obviously. I was with my parents who picked me up and took me to East Harlem.
East Harlem must have been a pretty vibrant place to arrive in as a child.
Yes, it was, and that's a very good word to describe it. The streets were packed with all kinds of people, young children, old people, people hanging out on their stoops, drinking beer or playing dominoes, all kinds of music playing out of people's windows. When I think back on those years, I felt accepted as part of this group, for the most part. You know, there were gangs, there was street fighting, trouble sometimes, but for the most part, it was a warm, very inclusive world.
And your parents, your mum, Pat, was from a farming family originally?
Well, my grandfather was an engineer, and her mother was a nurse. But I had visited her grandmother, who had a garden out in Minnesota. So that's why I think of her as a farm girl from Minnesota.
And your father, Ed Vega, was Puerto Rican. There is something in your music, too, of that world that he came from.
A little bit, because that's the neighborhood we grew up in. Mm-hmm. Ed Vega was actually my stepfather, and I do have another birth father that I found eventually. Mm-hmm. But the world that I grew up in those early days, was filled with all kinds of music, except classical, which I discovered a little later on.
You were about 9, I think, when you found out that, in fact, he was your stepfather.
That must have
taken some coming to terms with for a child.
Yes, it took me a few years, actually, to put all the pieces together and realize what had actually happened. I was very embraced by my Puerto Rican family. I'd spent time in Puerto Rico. I spoke Spanish. So I felt very comfortable in that world. So that was a bit of a shock. But it's better to know the truth.
Yeah.
And so I eventually figured it out.
This next piece has a wonderful inflection, doesn't it, of music from Brazil, in fact.
Yes, The Girl from Ipanema. I love this song because I love the way Astrud Gilberto sings. I remember as a very young child hearing this song on the radio, loving her voice. I felt she sang as simply and as raw as a child. And I somehow thought to myself, if I ever get to sing, I want to sound like that.
That's
because I liked her simple phrasing, that she had no frills. It was just the kind of voice that one would use to sing to your children.
This is pretty extraordinary, too, because it's got Stan Getz on the saxophone and João Gilberto on the guitar, so it's a rather wonderful lineup.
Yes. Ding, 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 bling, 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 bling. Tall and thin and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes, ah. When she walks, she's like a samba that swings so cool and sways so gently, that when she passes, each one she passes goes, ah. Oh, but you watch her so sadly. How can he tell her he loves her? Yes, he would give his heart gladly. But each day when she walks to the sea, she looks straight ahead, not at he.
like the way Stan scats on the voice, almost improvises around it, so that you're not sure almost which voice you're listening to at times.
Well, that's an interesting way of putting it. Yeah, I do, although I must say what my ear is always drawn to the vocal line and the melody. So I consider, it's terrible to say this, but I consider his line sort of more decorative. But the tone of the whole piece, all of it works together. It's very human, and I love it for that.
How did you get on as a school child, Suzanne?
Life as a child?
Yeah.
Some parts of it I loved. I loved school. I had my chums. But other parts of it were more difficult. You know, I had some problems at home. And so, you know, I found a world in books and made plans for myself and have realized a lot of them.
So. Did you want at that stage to sing?
I didn't have the confidence to sing. I was a quiet, inwardly looking sort of child, constantly being told to come out of myself, and I resisted that. So that seemed a little too radical. What I wanted to do was be a dancer. So at the age of 9, I started to study ballet. And this was a whole new world to me. This is where I started to hear classical music. It was a way of expressing myself, which didn't require speech, which was a relief. And I loved it. I stuck with it for 10 years.
I don't know whether this next music was something that you heard when you were fancying yourself as a ballet dancer. It's The Nutcracker.
Yes, I saw The Nutcracker, which I think is a lot of children's first experience of ballet. In fact, I've forgotten this, but it just came to mind right now. In the first grade, when I was 6 years old, I was actually in a small production of The Nutcracker in East Harlem, where I was cast as the narrator because I could read. And I announced myself at the end of the play. You were supposed to stand forward, say your name, and announce the role that you'd played. And I stepped forward and said, Suzanne Vega as the Nutcracker, as the star of the show. And everyone laughed, and I couldn't figure out why they were laughing until I realized I should have said the narrator. I eventually became familiar with the world of Tchaikovsky, and I've always loved this next piece.
Which movement have you chosen from it?
It's called Coffee, Arabian Dance. And I love it for the mystery, and there's a kind of Arabic feeling to the whole piece, to the strings. And I've always loved the way it kind of ends on the major. You know, it's very minor key, very mysterious all the way through, and then at the end there's this kind of reassuring major feeling to it.
Yes, it's quite striking, that chord, when it comes, isn't it?
Yes, and still so gentle. Yeah. You know, it's a major statement, but it kind of just creeps up there and then just leaves us there on a concluded note.
Coffee, the Arabian Dance from Act Two of Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Suite, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Mr. Slav Rostropovich. You went to the New York School of Performing Arts, immortalized, of course, in fame. Mm-hmm. Was it anything like the film or very different?
I thought it was very like the film. Mm-hmm. When I saw the film, in fact, I had just graduated 2 years before, and I said, yeah, I think they captured it really well. Mm-hmm. All the dancing, people really would dance at the lunchtime. Sometimes it would spill out into the street. The drama, you know, it's a school full of passionate, talented children, and there's just drama in every hallway.
You won a scholarship to study English and drama at Barnard College in New York. What drew you to those subjects?
Well, I always loved the arts, so I was always drawn to reading. And then I actually started in the theater as the wardrobe mistress. And I said I could sew buttons, so they said, you're hired. And I did that for a couple of years, but I had such a longing to be on the stage. That's where I secretly wanted to be. So I started to take some of the classes in the theater, and I eventually earned enough credits to minor in the theater, and I majored in English literature.
And I think a favorite book was Jane Eyre, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. One of many, many favorite books. But yeah, Jane Eyre, the story of a young, plain, smart, determined girl who makes her way in the world. I read it when I was 11, and I was just amazed.
Bartok next. What brought you to this piece?
This piece was a revelation to me. I think I was 15 years old, and I had a teacher at the High School of Performing Arts. I was a dance major there, and I'd been moved from the ballet department to the modern dance department because I just wasn't suited for the ballet department. So we were studying the Martha Graham technique. Her style was very severe, a lot of black. She had performed barefoot, and it was a technique that she developed on her own body of contraction and release from yoga of the breath, but she formalized it to very severe, strict lines and angles, almost military. And she also had her sense of humor, but it was very different from the world of ballet. And this was a piece that I danced to. I was so amazed by this piece when I first heard it. It seemed so radical and so revolutionary. I couldn't believe that you were allowed to make music like this. It was as though someone had discovered punk rock. It was like, you can actually do this. You can have all this tapping and these noises and then this very anxious music. I finally realized there's a way to express this state of feeling. It was very exciting to me and very moving.
Bartok, you're quite right in what you were saying about the odd sounds he would get, because he completely revolutionized in some ways writing for strings and what the string could do. He loved insects at night and things like that, and the music is suffused with these sounds of nature and Hungarian folk music too.
Yes, and also how he used percussion. I'd never thought, I guess, of percussion as an instrument that wasn't specifically rhythmic. You know, that this you could use it for as a texture and as a way of creating an atmosphere.
Thank you. It's an extraordinary act of imagination. What was it like to dance to?
Oh, it was amazing. I could even feel the cue in my body as I was listening to it. I was like, oh, here's my entrance. The movements were very agonized, you know, tortured. There's the Martha Graham sort of contract and release. And so I still remember my bit and how to travel, where to go with it. But actually listening to it now without having to perform in it, it's fascinating because you think to yourself, well, what is this? What's going on? What's the narrative here? Because we all feel this way sometimes. It's a sense of anxiety. Mm-hmm. And to hear it so perfectly expressed, I just still have that sense of wonder.
We heard the Adagio, the third movement from Bela Bartok's Music for Strings, Percussion and Celesta, performed by the Helsinki Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Susanna Malkki. Interestingly, Bartok was very keen on folk music, Hungarian folk music. And, of course, it was folk music of a different nature that grabbed you when you were young.
Yes. I was drawn to the world of folk music, first of all, because my stepfather played it in the house. I loved all the little stories. Anything with animals in it, I used to sing to my brothers and sisters. So it was very much part of my world growing up. The other thing I loved about it was the simplicity of playing the guitar. And that way you could pick up this guitar and go and play anywhere at any time.
When did you begin performing, Suzanne? Can you remember your first gig?
Yes, definitely. I was 16 years old. I'd been given a half an hour to perform in a church basement at 86th Street, West End Avenue. That was a thrill.
Did you do your own music at that point, or was it standards?
I did my own music. From time to time, I would attempt a cover. And I was told to stop doing that. Even if I didn't get the job, they would say, don't bother doing covers, you know, do your own material. Even though I had complaints that it was too poetic. If I could write that stuff, I could write real songs.
At the time, there would have been quite a bit of punk around, wouldn't there? Something very different.
Very different, yes. Mm. And I did not understand it until I went to my first show, and that was Lou Reed in 1979. And I was amazed at what I saw, which was as much theater as it was music, because he was way into this very aggressive, smoking cigarettes and throwing the lighted ones into the audience, and the audience was shouting back. And I started to listen to the actual songs, and I realized what a good songwriter he was. The song that really struck me was a song called Caroline Says Part 2, and I bought the Berlin album, which, interestingly, it's the, I think, the only one where he plays acoustic guitar. And I was amazed at what you could do with an acoustic guitar and how blunt his songs were. That became something I wanted to learn from.
Did you get to know him at all?
I did. I met him probably 7 years after that first show. And we became lifelong friends eventually, which was very gratifying. It was a very interesting dynamic relationship.
Well, the terrible thing about choosing music for a program like this is that one could easily have some Lou Reed next, but in fact, you've chosen Ella Fitzgerald, haven't you?
Partly because I listened a lot to this album. I used to do the dishes and I would play this. I loved her voice. I love the songs. I love the orchestrations. And it described to me this kind of glamorous world of the 30s and 40s, and of course it's the song Manhattan. I've always lived in Manhattan since I'm 2 years old, and I still live there today.
Summer journeys to Niagara and to other places aggravate all our cares. We'll save our fares. I've a cozy little flat in what is known as Old Manhattan. We'll settle down right here in town. We'll have Manhattan, the Bronx and Staten Island too. It's lovely going through the very fancy on old Delancey Street, you know. The subway charms us so when balmy breezes blow to and fro. And tell me what street compares with Mott Street in July. Sweet push carts gently gliding by. The great big city's a wondrous toy, just made for a girl and boy. We'll turn Manhattan into an Isle of Joy. We'll go to Yonkers, where true love conquers in the wilds, and starve together, dear, in Childs. We'll go to Coney and eat bologna on a roll. In Central Park we'll stroll, where our first kiss we stole, soul to soul. And my fair lady is a terrific show, they say. We both may see it close someday. The city's glamour can never spoil the dreams of a boy and girl. We'll turn Manhattan into an Isle of Joy.
Manhattan, Ella Fitzgerald, from the album Ella Fitzgerald Sings Rodgers and Hart, the songbook. Your eponymous first album, Suzanne Vega, came out in May 1985 and smashed all expectations, selling 200,000 copies in the US, 300,000 in the UK. On that album, you wrote a song called Cracking, which was about a fairly traumatic experience in your life living away from home.
Yes, you've done your research. Yes, I moved out when I was 19 and lived with a woman who had a bit of a breakdown. And I absorbed a lot of the energy that she was going through, and had my own issues as well. And so I wrote the song Cracking that reflected all of that. And I had also been influenced by Lou Reed, who I had just seen perform. I started to feel like a new way of writing for myself that allowed me to express this feeling of someone falling apart.
In Cracking, you referred to your state of mind being like the deep freeze, which is interesting. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there was a state of mind I used to have as a child when I felt trapped. I used to have code names, which I still invent for myself, for either states of being or sometimes with a certain person, I'll give them a certain name or a little label. You know, it's a private way of communicating. And so this state of mind was called the deep freeze, and it meant a sort of terrible stillness where I was almost paralyzed with either fear or overwhelmed by whatever emotions were going on in the house. It was very visual to me. It was like a gray world that sort of faded down into a kind of navy blue at the bottom. It was like a twilight cold zone, and I would feel very cold. I'm feeling cold in my body even thinking of it now. And I couldn't really move. I couldn't really run away, or it was hard for me to respond. And I would eventually snap out of it if something happened.
Do you still experience that feeling sometimes?
Rarely. I've just learned to use words to express feelings in other ways other than just to feel overwhelmed by them. This is what art is so good for, is to express states of mind, states of being, states of feeling.
Because it's an abstract art, so you don't have to spell it out necessarily. You can just draw on things.
Right, and you're still communicating. You're still letting it out. I had an interesting talk once with Philip Glass, who I worked with many times over the years. And he surprised me one day by saying, he said, you know, I've worked with Paul Simon, and he has this song called The Photograph. And he said, do you know that he's actually used a photograph from his own life? And I was like, Philip, of course he did. I mean, that's the way you write a song. That seemed like such a novel idea to him. I don't think he saw music as a way of expressing something personal or private. I think he went about music in a completely different way. Although if you look at some of the works that he's done, you could probably connect them to something in his private life, but I don't know that he would see that connection.
That's very interesting because, yeah. I mean, we all arrive at creating music in different ways, and there isn't a right way and there isn't a wrong way.
Exactly.
But I do think your music very much comes from a sort of inner soul and inner philosophy.
Yeah, there's three elements to the way I like to work. One is what one feels and knows, which is, of course, a great beginning. But if that's all you write about, it gets very tedious. You know, you don't always want to listen to someone's feelings, frankly, no matter how genuine they are. The second element is what you see and what you observe. You know, what's true, what's real, what's out there in the real world. And then there's always that wonderful third element of what you imagine. How could it be? How could it have been? What is this other thing? Sometimes it may be an element from a dream, a detail or some odd notion. And that just gives the whole thing a twist or a bit of magic that otherwise wouldn't be in there. That's how it works for me.
In one of your early hit songs, Luca, on the next album, actually, it was Solitude Standing, you also spoke very bravely about abuse. And was this again based on some personal experience?
It was. For a long time, I mean, obviously I created a character, and for years I would deflect. I never said no. I never said, no, this is not about me. But I did say there was a boy named Luca. He did live upstairs from me. He was not abused. And the next question was always like, did you know someone who was abused? And I would say, yes, I did. But I never would confess that that was me. And I'm glad I did that because I was not prepared at that time to talk about it in public. So it was a technique that worked for me. But it was, in fact, about my own experiences as a child.
This was more about brutality than sexual abuse, wasn't it?
The song is about brutality, yes.
Very few people do write about that kind of experience. Were you anxious about sharing that song with the world?
I was, yes. I was very careful in the beginning where I sang it. Most people honestly seemed to be sort of oblivious to it. Some of them didn't really know what it was about. And people who had figured out what it was about, it seemed to trouble them and they would look down at the floor and they would seem sad. So when my manager told me that he thought it to be a hit, I was just astonished. I said, are you kidding me? But he felt that it was a song about an issue. And this mattered to him a lot. And it was the 80s then, and he didn't really care for 80s pop music. But he felt that the music of the 70s had helped to change things, helped to stop the war. So he persuaded me that he thought it could be a single. And I said, okay, as long as I don't have to change the lyrics or my way of singing or my way of dressing or being, knock yourself out, I think is what I said. And so the rest is history.
Prince was a fan of that song, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He sent me a beautiful, beautiful letter.
Rachmaninoff next, a composer for many people able to put a degree of melancholia, of psychological concerns into his music.
Yes, I guess that is a way of putting it. I've always thought of it as a deep passion that comes out. For some reason, I've always thought of Anna Karenina and what she goes through in that great book and her passions and her loves and her despairs. And even though I was in college and I'd stopped dancing by then, I would sort of throw myself around the room in private while listening to this, you know, imagining all kinds of things.
Private passions made public.
Yes.
Rachmaninoff playing his own prelude in G sharp minor. He was a wonderful pianist, had very big hands. Oh. So he wrote music that taxes some pianists with smaller hands. He could stretch a very wide distance.
Oh, I can't wait to hear it.
Thank you.
It's extraordinary how that simple device of a note falling a semitone, dee-dum, dee-dee, can be so lachrymose and so powerful. Do you do that in your songs at all?
I probably do. I mean, a lot of what I do is very unconscious, so I go for a certain tone or a mood or a feeling, and I express the feeling through the guitar or a melody. So it is amazing because you're just veering off just the smallest amount, but you get a huge amount of mileage in doing exactly that.
My guest today on Private Passions is the Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Suzanne Vega. So do you have, Suzanne, a kind of process that works for you? I mean, to start off with, do the lyrics always come first or does the musical idea come first?
At this point in my life, I've written songs all different kinds of ways with all kinds of things coming first. The best ones, I think, come with the melody first because those are the clearest musical ideas. Other times I've had whole stanzas, whole verses written and then had to set music to it. Sometimes it's a title, Cracking. I wrote that from the title down. Sometimes it's an image. The Queen and the Soldier began with this image of a queen in a castle and having a problem. She's a red queen. And so there's all kinds of ways to get into a song.
Which came first in Tom's Diner?
Oh, the melody. Mm. I was walking down the street and the melody popped into my head and I thought, oh, I've got to do something with this. I had just come from eating at Tom's restaurant and I thought, I'll call it Tom's Diner. Then sketched out this little song about an alienated person at breakfast who misses their loved one.
Initially, it was an a cappella version on your 1987 album, Solitude Standing. What did you think when you began to hear the remix of electronic duo DNA in 1990?
I loved it right away. I thought it was funny. I thought it was cool. I thought it was really a brilliant idea. I wasn't sure how it would be received by an audience, but I thought, let's buy it from them and release it ourselves and, you know, just see what happens. And the next thing I know, it was top 10 hit all around the world.
It's been sampled hundreds of times by artists as diverse as Destiny's Child, Drake, and Snoop Dogg, and was even used as a test by Karlheinz Brandenburg during the creation of the MP3 format. Why do you think he chose that tune?
I think he chose that tune to refine the MP3 because it's such a simple vocal. He said he had thought he had already finished the MP3, and he said, if I truly am finished, I can run this simple vocal through it, and it will recreate it faithfully. And instead, what happened was this horrible noise that sounded just like Linda Blair in The Exorcist. And the way they got that Linda Blair Exorcist voice was by electronic distortion. So it was the worst Tom's Diner I'd ever heard in my life. And they played it for me so I could see how much work they had to do to actually refine the MP3. It took months for them to keep running the vocal through until they feel they recreate it faithfully and perfectly.
It led to being called the mother of the MP3, didn't it?
Yes, apparently I'm the mother of the MP3.
Tom's Diner has a meditative quality to it with repetitive refrains. Do you like minimalist music?
I was very influenced by minimalism, partly because I'm a Buddhist. And so in my daily practice, I chant, and I chant a phrase over and over again, and this is a way of expressing prayer. And so when I hear Steve Reich or I hear Philip Glass, I feel myself to be in a very familiar, rhythmic, pulsing world, which I love and I feel myself to be a part of.
What Steve Reich does so fascinatingly is to take sections of music and then layer it with things which are slightly out of phase. And it's the friction that creates which becomes very teasing to the ear, doesn't it?
Yeah, and then it leads you forward, and then suddenly he's shifted you into a new shimmering, pulsing thing, and then you never stay in that one place too long. So it's still dynamic. It's not like Lamont Young, where I once attended a concert where he played one note for a whole hour. And I remember thinking, how am I going to stay awake through this? But it was really amazing, but it was still just the one note. So you're not experiencing that in a Steve Reich piece. You're shifting and moving from moment to moment, and it's still dynamic.
The Music of Steve Reich, Section 2 of Music for 18 Musicians. Susan Vega, did your life change very dramatically when you suddenly were selling that number of records?
Yes, it did. For years, I would threaten to go back to my job as a receptionist if things didn't work out.
Or a wardrobe mistress.
Yeah, I'll go back to being the wardrobe mistress. So this allowed me to leave my day job. Not that there's anything wrong with having a day job, but it was a thrill to be without one. And I've been able to make my living ever since doing my art, which is what I really love.
In your late 20s, you tracked down your biological father, Richard Peck. That must have been profoundly emotional, I should have thought. Are you close now?
Yes, we became close right away. I mean, his voice sounded so familiar to me when I first heard it on the phone. And I found out he had been adopted as a child and that his parents had been touring musicians in the vaudeville circuit in the 1930s. And my grandmother, in fact, had been a drummer, which was unusual for that time or any time. So this was astonishing to me to realize that I'd actually come from a musical family. So it's been a wonderful relationship, and we're still very close.
You began a relationship with musician and record producer Mitchell Froom, who produced your fourth album, 99.9 Fahrenheit Degrees, on which you embraced quite an electronic style. What was it like working together on that?
It was very exciting. I knew him as the producer of bands like Crowded House. I knew him as basically a pop producer. But once we started working together, I realized that his scope went way beyond that, that he had a lot of talents and he knew a lot about all kinds of music. He could do string arrangements. He had a great musical imagination. So we had this great working chemistry that, you know, heated up and, well, resulted in a child.
Yes, Ruby, I was going to say there was not just music.
And a marriage.
Yeah.
Right. So it was a very, very exciting time for me, a real thrill to think back on those days. He would work with his engineer, Chad Blake, who was also revolutionary in the way he thought about space and sound and how to create these albums with a lot of depth.
That continued, that relationship, until 1998. And then you remarried, and that has all that romantic side to it.
Yes, yes it does. I had dated Paul Mills in the early 80s. We dated from 1981 to 83. And he had asked me to marry him in 1983. And I told him I needed to think about it, which he took as a rejection. And then 23 years later, he asked me again if I had thought about it. And I had thought about it. And then he asked me again, and this time I said yes. So I married him 23 years later, and we've been together nearly 20 years now.
Persistence paid off.
Yes.
The clarinet next. And this is a wonderful piece by Poulenc, who really exploits the nature of the instrument. Why do you love it?
This one brings me right back to, again, I must have been 15 or 16. There was a guest choreographer named Keith Lee. I think he was using the whole piece, but I think I danced in the second movement. And there's something really moving to me about this whole piece. When I listened to it again recently, it brought tears to my eyes. There's something about the melody, the way it comes in. And Poulenc is a little loose with the structure, so you don't really quite know what's happening. And when the melody comes in, it's just like it hits you all over. Because in the beginning, he's sort of noodling around. But somehow when that melody comes in, it is so poignant.
I've always thought about Poulenc, who actually I knew, met with my father. But he was somebody who defied the normal musical forms, which you've just mentioned. But he was so individual a character that it doesn't matter. It just works somehow.
Exactly. Yes, and if he had started with that melody, you would have thought, oh, that's a great melody. But somehow, because he sets up this atmosphere, and you're thinking, okay, well, what's going on here? Then it hits you, and it's really overpowering. And then at the end, he repeats the melody, but in a different way, and he sort of plays with it. It's really fascinating to see what he's done with the form there. And it's so effective. Emotionally, it just hits you right there.
Thank you. The Romanza, the second movement from Francis Poulenc's Sonata for Clarinet and Piano, performed by Michel Portal on the clarinet and Pascal Roger playing the piano. Let's talk a little bit about Carson McCullers, because I know you're very obsessed with her. Now, who was she, and where did this obsession for you begin?
Carson McCullers was a writer. She was from the Deep South. Her most famous book came out in 1940 when she was 21 years old. It was a book called The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, and it made her a worldwide literary celebrity. And she led a very tumultuous life. She drank, she smoked, she married and divorced her husband and then remarried him. There were lots of affairs, both real and imagined, I think, on both sides. So I discovered her while I was at Barnard College in the theater department. I was part of a musical ensemble class, and the assignment was come in, dressed as someone who was in the arts and no longer alive, and be ready to field questions as though you're on TV. So there was a new biography of hers that came out in 1975. I saw the photo on the cover of this book, and I thought, I sort of look like her. And I decided I would be her for this assignment. Got the book out of the library, read as much as I could overnight, got myself a jacket. I already had the hairstyle and a pack of cigarettes and came in ready to play the role. And it was so much fun that it became my senior thesis. I wrote a one-woman play back then to graduate. And then for the last 10 years, I've been sort of spending time in and out of the theaters doing other versions of that piece.
She was also a pianist, wasn't she, before she became a writer?
Yes, she was a terrifically talented pianist. She played as a young girl. In fact, she wrote about that in a story called Wunderkind. I think she was always afraid of being a disappointment. And she came to New York City to study at Juilliard. The story is she gave all her money to her friend to hold and never saw it again. And instead she became a writer for the rest of her life.
Next, the Mozart Symphony No. 40 in G minor, one of the great Mozart symphonies. What brought you to this choice?
Well, at some point I'd studied music. I'd tried to study music 7 times during the course of my life. And this was one of those times I'd taken a music listening class, and this was one of the pieces I liked. If you can't tell by now, I love pieces in minor keys with glorious string arrangements, and this is Mozart. If Poulenc is sort of like revolutionary in terms of form, Mozart is just, he hits you in the face with it, and then he keeps hitting you in the face with it, with all its variations. So there's no mystery about the statement there, but it's exciting and it's passionate.
Would you describe yourself as a romantic?
In some ways, but I have a very cold, practical side as well, which some people see more of that side than the romantic side, but I think they're both in there.
Thank you. We heard the first movement from Mozart's Symphony No. 40 in G minor, performed by Kammerakademie Potsdam and conducted by Antonello Manacorda. Susan Vega, you founded your own record label, Amanuensis. How did you come to that name?
I always have trouble naming things. So I was casting around for a name. And the idea of an amanuensis is a servant who sort of takes down dictation. So I thought, well, that's an interesting idea. Because at its best, when you write a song, it's as though you're taking dictation from a sort of higher source. It sort of flows through you, and you write it down. But the other meaning of the word amanuensis is that I started this company so that I could own my own recording masters, because the original ones were owned by Universal. And I wanted to own my own recordings of my own works. So this became a little joke in my mind. It's like amanuensis is the company where the servant owns the masters, which is my play on words. Thank you for
Don Giovanni.
I appreciate that.
You talked earlier about Philip Glass, and you actually narrated Einstein on the Beach, didn't you?
Yes.
With Ictus and Collegium Vocale Ghent, two great instrumental ensembles from Belgium. It's hugely long, 200 minutes. How is it to do that night after night?
It's a thrill. The original one, I think, was 5.5 hours, and we do the abbreviated version of 3.5 hours. And I do all 5 narrator parts. And it's a world in which I get to enter, do my part, and then leave the stage and then come back. So it's, again, very familiar to me, this whole world of minimalism, the counting, the repetitions. I get a thrill from it. It makes me feel very alive and in the moment, especially in the moment of performing. I think we're probably going to do some more of those next year, I hope.
What have you chosen from Philip Glass?
I chose a piece from the soundtrack of Mishima. I loved this soundtrack when it came out. I was absolutely obsessed with it in 1986 when I was working on the Solitude Standing album. I had gone through a breakup. I was feeling very, you know, heart-wrenched and just kept listening to the soundtrack over and over. When I saw Philip, I told him how much I loved it, and I asked him, were you going through something at the time that made you come out with this passionate minor key music? And he just looked at me like I was mad. He said, no, I just wrote it. So I thought, oh, okay. Well, I used it. I took great comfort from it, and I feel that the song Solitude Standing itself has a bit of this feel to it.
so extraordinary to think, Suzanne Vega, that if we had been walking down Fifth Avenue 40, 50 years ago, I know that's unlikely in your case, and tried to hail a cab, we might have caught one being driven by one Philip Glass.
That's exactly right, yes. Yeah, he had his day job for a long time.
Yeah. That was November the 25th, Ichigaya, and I hope he drove a little more gently than that. That was from the soundtrack of Mishima, and it was performed by, amongst others, the Kronos Quartet, and the conductor was Michael Riesman. Your latest album is called Flying with Angels, first new album, really, of new material for 10 or 11 years. And is there any central theme, motivation running behind it?
Yes. The songs range from, really, from rats to angels. It's really a hell and heaven and everything in between, and the struggles that go on in life. Every song has its secret struggle at the heart of it. There's a lot of contrast in this album. Every song has a slightly different genre, but that's the main theme, is this struggling to survive.
And do you find that having certain musicians come, especially for particular songs, really inspires you too? I mean, there's Jerry Leonard on here, isn't there? The guitarist who played with David Bowie.
Oh, yes. Jerry has turned out in the long run to be a really good collaborator. We met back in 2000, I think, and he approached me very shortly after we began to play together, and he said something very cryptic. He said, "I can play your guitar parts the way you play them." And I said, "Thanks, but, you know, I'm playing them, so, you know, don't think about it." But then I broke my arm. I said, "Where's that guy who said he could play my guitar parts like me?" So I hired him, and that became 25 years now of playing together in various ways as a duo. And also, he's my musical director, and on this album, he's the producer.
We're coming to the end of the program, sadly, Suzanne Vega. But we're going to end as we began, with Claude Debussy, aren't we?
Yes. This is a piece called The Snow is Dancing, which was a surprise to me when I heard the title, because this is another song Ruby used to play as a teenager at the piano. And her way of working on a piece was to sit and attack it. So she would attack this one fiercely, and it has all this kind of circular motions. And I literally thought this was a piece about someone having a nervous breakdown until I...
Because you were about to have one listening and listening.
I loved it, and I loved her passion for it. And I thought, I need to find out, what is this song about? To my surprise, it's a children's corner. Snow is dancing. So it's really the snowflake sort of whirling around in a little lovely pattern floating down, which I think is a very nice way to end the time.
Suzanne Vega, to your daughter and to you, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
The Snow is Dancing from the Children's Corner Suite by Claude Debussy, performed by Zoltán Kocsis. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the singer-songwriter Suzanne Vega. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. Next week, Michael will be talking to the archaeologist Gabriel Zuchtriegel, the director of one of the world's most important archaeological sites, Pompeii, of which around a third is yet to be explored. Gabriel's choices include Bach, Mozart, Schubert and Vivaldi. He talks to Michael next week at the usual time, just after midday, here on BBC Radio 3.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music.
This is the sound of Renaissance Rome.
Composer of the Week with Donald MacLeod.
The work of a musical genius, Giovanni da Palestrina. From pivotal creations to personal reinventions, join me as we unravel the mystery surrounding the so-called saviour of church music, 500 years since his birth. Composer of the Week, Palestrina, starts tomorrow afternoon from 4 on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
Choral Vespers comes from Buckfast Abbey in Devon at 3. Well, now at 1:30, it's time here on Radio 3 for this week's edition of Music Map.
Hello, I'm Sarah Moore-Peach. Welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map. The summer solstice is less than a week away, and on the morning itself, hundreds of thousands of people across the Northern Hemisphere will be getting up early to watch that first spot of liquid gold appearing on the horizon as the sun rises on the longest day of the year. This string quartet by Joseph Haydn is nicknamed the Sunrise Quartet because of this first movement and the way that he paints that sonic horizon line of static strings while the first violin rises above them like the golden orb of the sun. And it's this piece of music that we're working our way towards on today's show. It'll take us about an hour and 20 minutes to reach the destination. And in that time, the sun is going to rise approximately 12 more times as we listen into other musical depictions of the start of the day. Let's begin in Norway and the land of the midnight sun. This is the fresh morning music of Edvard Grieg.